Welcome back to Decouple. I am joined by James Krellenstein for what we have promised to be Vogel Part 4. We have an hour and a half, the finale. I'm hoping we can pull it off. Again, I wouldn't cry. I think a lot of our listenerships would not cry if a fifth was required.
But no.
I don't think it's necessary. You don't think it's necessary.
God, not.
But all that to say, you know, it's been very well received. I was at the Canadian Nuclear Association conference, and I had a lot of people coming up to me. Very grateful, James, for your insights. A lot of the Westinghouse folks have been listening to it and studying it carefully, at least those manning the booth. For that kind of, you know, we have a much broader audience that taps in on the more sort of general energy content. It does narrow down on Vogel Part 3, and it probably narrow down further on Vogel Part 4. But for those diehard listeners, I feel a special obligation to make this content.
For the niche Westinghouse fans.
Yes. Project managers. Okay. Anyway, so yeah. James, I have a few things, obviously, I want to talk about. I understand you've been collecting some data on some of the Chinese cap builds and seeing some positive things there in terms of things moving quicker, schedules advancing more rapidly. I was just looking at a couple articles, and to be honest, they didn't seem to be terribly high quality, but looking at positive and the phenomenon of negative learning within nuclear. And I guess one of the big questions coming out of the difficulties at Vogel is, will the next AP1000 be cheaper? It seems like it can't help but be. But in terms of that broad prospect, we do see that worrying sign that certainly compared to wind and solar, for instance, with an incredibly positive learning rate, we see a lot of stagnation in terms of cost from the early days. Fairly significant positive learning may be confounded by just going up in unit size, moving from tens of megawatts to hundreds of megawatts. But it seems like the rule tends to be either negative learning, or else, you know, I think the Koreans are the only real outlier there in terms of bringing costs down somewhat. Anyway, so that's kind of what I want to touch on, but I'm sure you've thought this out a lot more in terms of where you want to go to wrap up the story.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, there's a question of, will the next AP1000 be cheaper? And I think my perspective is it almost would be very, very hard. it would be very hard for it not to be cheaper.
Sure.
And that's because, you know, the three primary problems that we saw at Vogel, and once again, we're taking a decade-long mega project that's literally 30 billion bucks, and we're distilling it down to, you know, three lessons that could be said in 45 seconds. So, you know, take it with a very large grain of salt. But you know, an incomplete design. And once again, you know, as I was mentioning in the pre-call, right, like the pre-recording, the virtual green room, is that the cost, I think, I was talking to an MIT student actually up, and we were actually just running up at MIT last week, who actually is a big fan of Decouple. And we were just running through the license amendment request, you know, those 188, 189 license amendment requests on Vogel and on Summer. And, you know, one of the incomplete design was just driving so many delays, so many needs to go back to the NRC on the standardized design, that it really started to, it was a massive, massive driver of project costs and project schedule overrun. And when you're talking about a nuclear power plant where literally because of interest and financing costs, we're talking about a single day of delay is $1 million in excess cost, roughly speaking. That's a huge, huge factor. And we just can't not have a incomplete design. Now, so that's the first thing. We have a design that is complete, that is operating, and that is licensed by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, the caveat to that lesson is what's going on over in our European friends. Right. And they are building the European pressurized water reactor, which they built in Finland at OL3. They built in France at Flamanville 3. And then they also built in China 2 units. And now they're building, of course, in the United Kingdom. And, you know, the UK project is not going, Hinkley Point C is not exactly going well. And I think the important lesson to learn there really is that, if you change the design, you kind of don't get the advantage of a completed design. And the thing that I've heard from the EDF folks essentially is, they are changing the design a lot as they're going from each EPR to each EPR. And we have even further design evolution now with Macron and EDF announcing the EPR 2, right? An evolution of that EPR design. So once again, we have a complete design at Vogtle, obviously, that's operating, that's producing now both units. I mean, 4 is still in commissioning, but we saw it go up to 100% power just last week. We have Vogtle 3 in commercial operation, operating really, really well. So the critical question that we need to ask is, are we going to make sure that we keep that design stable? And if we do, then we really have an opportunity to reap the advantage of it. The second thing, of course, was the supply chain, right? That the supply chain broke down on Vogtle 3 and Vogtle 4 mid-build. Right. The question is that supply chain robust enough right now that it won't break down, obviously, again, during the build? But even as a second corollary, can we glom up enough orders for AP1000s outside of China so that the suppliers of those modules in that supply chain are properly incentivized to invest the labor and capital into making sure that that supply chain can deliver these modules on time and on budget? And then the third thing was just the general rustiness that we had in the United States' sort of labor force and skilled labor and manual labor in building a nuclear power plant. We haven't obviously, the last nuclear power plant before Vogtle 3 and Summer 2 that started was Sharon Harris, unit number 1, I believe in North Carolina. I think I wound up confused with North Carolina and South Carolina. And Sharon Harris started in 1978. Started nuclear construction in 1978. So I think that a really big question that we need to ask here is we had this massive pause. We have another pause now because there's no AP1000 orders yet that have been announced. If we want to keep that labor force actually keeping going, keeping people in those trades that are nuclear qualified and competent, we really do need to see an order relatively soon. So this is sort of where we are right now. We have both the pros, right, where we have a complete design. At least the shop drawings for those modules are done. We have the potential to get a really good supply chain running. And we have a labor force that at least to some extent has been through this, although they are now probably diffusing as we speak around the country and around the world. The critical question is, in the next couple of years, can we get enough orders together of AP1000s to make sure that we keep on running down that cost curve and capitalize on these lessons? And I think that in some ways is what I am focusing on, what I believe is the next move and sort of what I'm going to be focusing my career on, is how do we make sure that we have AP1000s and we're doing this in a way, orders in the United States, and we're doing this in a way that we can retain all those knowledges and start going down those learning.
So I definitely want to touch on what I'll call design instability, and maybe we can talk about that more broadly. I'm not sure the degree to which the Chinese have modified the design. I think they have the licensing right to do so, but they're the ones building future iterations, I guess. I'm not sure, again, how derivative they are, how different they are. But before we get there, just in terms of supply chain, so you've described to us in enough detail anyway, the modules, submodules, how they're put together. I'm just curious in terms of what the facilities look like that are building these modules. We know that the modules are assembled or were assembled in Vogtle on site in a specialized facility. But the factories that were tooled up to design these modules, are they kind of specific to doing only that task? Or I imagine they still, physical structures still exist and they're just on to building other stuff. I imagine they haven't built any modules in the last couple of years. So could those factories come back into operation doing what they did just 2 or 3 years ago, or you know, what in terms of the kind of permanence or stability of that supply chain itself, how much longer can we go in terms of years out until those facilities are no longer able to be brought back into operation?
So I think, you know, the original concept back in the noughties, you know, in the 2000s, as to use your term, was to have actually a real main centralized supplier, which was this Shaw Lake Charles facility in Louisiana that was going to be the main supplier of the submodules.
For like, right? 15 different AP1000s at that time, right?
Or yeah, I mean, we licensed a bunch of AP1000s all across the country, right? And it really did seem, you know, before I think the fracking revolution hit and Fukushima and you know, Vogel itself, right? It really did seem like there was going to be a nuclear renaissance in the United States. And so we had a centralized facility that was going to be the major, not 100%, but the major supplier of those AP1000 structural and piping and electrical modules. And obviously, as you know, as we've talked about ad nauseum, that broke down mid-construction in Vogel and Summers' case. And we saw, you know, you could see this in the sort of publicly available documentation as well as private documentation, that, you know, basically people went out into the world and tried to find other submodule suppliers. So it went all over the place, right, where you had people in everywhere from Florida to Oregon to Newport News shipyard, right, which obviously makes our aircraft carriers as well as some of our nuclear submarines. People went out to South Korea and Japan. Toshiba and IHI began fabricating some of this stuff. Always, some of the major components were fabricated in Italy. So we really did see what was originally a global but somewhat centralized supply chain. We started to just go out to various ASME NSTAMP qualified suppliers all over the world, kind of in a last ditch effort to save the plant. And the critical question that I think Westinghouse needs to answer now much more is, what is the state of the supply chain? And is it really tooled up to be able to not have that experience happen again?
Right. It's
and yeah.
I just remember seeing a photo. I'm not sure if it was called Shoes or Charlouze or it's a French name. It was one of the big factories where they were, I think, building something like 8 reactor pressure vessels every year. The way things were tooled up for the Mesmer plant, for instance, quite different, very centralized, and able to rapidly deploy.
And that facility in, I think it's Creusot,
right? That's it. Yeah.
Outside of Dijon. It's still there, actually. And it's still, if you look at where like the EPR steam generators come from, it is there. And I believe major components of the reactor pressure vessel for the EPRs are still assembled there. But as you're saying, like any mass produced good, the sort of brilliance of the Mesmer plan was the French centralized everything, you know, as a grand national project. And they had, you know, dozens literally of the first reactor design, that CPY series, those 900 megawatt electrical three loop designs that were based on the Westinghouse plants at Beaver Valley in North Anna in the United States. They just sort of minted those out with very, very little design variation, especially on the nuclear island between those plants. Nothing like what the United States did. Now, on the flip side, what we should be really clear about is the AP1000 is highly standardized. And it does seem, even in the Chinese to US builds, there is some difference in the shield building configuration in particular that is in the Chinese AP1000s versus the US, because they don't have the aircraft impact assessment rule. But most of the designs and tooling are really, really quite similar. And so much so that in the Chinese AP1000s, of course, China's on a 50 hertz grid, the United States is on a 60 hertz grid. Right. If you look at just the way the reactor coolant pumps run in the Chinese AP1000, right, they actually run off 100% of the time off the variable frequency drives, right, which are used to adjust the speed of the reactor coolant pumps, because the pumps are designed at 60 hertz. The Chinese input grid mains power is at 50 hertz. So they need to basically up the frequency up through the VFDs, where in the United States they just bypass and go directly at full power to the mains power. Now, one of the things that I think we should say that is really, really impressive, and to give you the bull's case about how this is what the Chinese did, it is really, I think a lot of people in the US nuclear industry and around the world are really shocked that the Chinese are building half a dozen right now Chinese AP1000s. And that's because the Chinese ostensibly have a fully indigenized reactor design, the Hualong One, which is actually based on that three-loop French design, but with a lot of Chinese indigenous innovation, including new steam generator design, new passive safety features as well. And just as a matter of national pride, people really thought the Hualong One was going to dominate the Chinese builds. But the operating performance of the AP1000 plants at Sanmen and Haiyang are so superior, are so great, that the Chinese really do seem to be convinced, and the operating experience seems to be so good with the AP1000s that they're going ahead with building these Chinese AP1000s. And I have to say, as we were talking about before, we're running a project right now tracking the sort of the progress of the Chinese AP1000s and just looking at the what we call the big six modules. So that's CA20, CA01 through CA05 being placed in the nuclear island. And we're going about 75% faster than we were, in some cases, in order of magnitude faster than we were on the first Chinese builds, which really gives you the idea that if you actually have a highly modularized design like the AP1000 and you have a supply chain that actually is working, you have a complete design, you don't have to change anything mid-design, these things really can go probably faster than anything else that we have right now in our arsenal. So that is a really compelling case for the United States getting on and other participants around the world, right, for getting on and building more AP1000s.
And so when you talk about everything speeding up, that's the sub-module fabrication, that's you know, the module assembly facilities, that's the crane lifts. Like, is there a certain part of that, or it's just the design's done, the supply chain's there, the ASMAN stamp labor is there, and it's all flowing as a result of right. that?
So what we look at is the time from start of nuclear construction to the time that we call the modules are placed into the into their place in the either nuclear island or in the auxiliary building on the base mat or wherever they're going to go in. And you know, a huge problem that we had at Vogtle at Summer and at Sanmen and Haiyang is because the designs for the modules weren't done, right? And the module supply chain was broken. It would just take a long time to even for the modules, for all the sub-module pieces to be on site to be assembled. And therefore, you know, the sub-modules aren't there. You can't place the module into the plant, right? And even the Chinese, right, had this issue. Once again, you know, I think if one of the lessons that you take out of this sort of, you know, saga of these decouple series is that, you know, the Chinese builds of the AP1000s were not noticeably faster than the American builds were. And I think that's pretty shocking because China generally builds large light water reactors in a median of around 5.5 years, depending on how you calculate it. And it took them about 9 years, 5 months to build Sanmen Unit Number 1. And, you know, it took 10 years of nuclear construction and some change in Vogtle, right? So, you know, what we were saying is, okay, if our hypothesis was correct, that all of this was, you know, the supply chain breaking down, the design being incomplete, and so on, then with all that sort of fixed, we should really see the Chinese builds going dramatically faster of the next generation. And that's what we're exactly seeing right now. We are seeing it going so much faster than they were even in China on the first generation. So it is all of those things.
Do you have a sense that they're going to get down to that 5.5 year median build time or even better? When are the next Chinese AP1000s coming online?
I would be putting on a bet that, and you know, famous mistake, but that the Chinese AP1000s may be the fastest builds in China, and maybe it even brings it beats the CANDU builds in the 90s, because I really do believe that the modular sort of configuration that Westinghouse did here really can allow for dramatic speed up in building, assuming, you know, all of the stuff that we talked about before is there. And that is there in China. It's not there in the United States. And one of the key problems that we have in the US right now, or even the Western world, if we want to build AP1000s, is that we can't tap in, for geopolitical reasons, the Chinese module supply chain, right? So we are going to have to build our own supply chain right now in the
In terms of those Chinese AP1000s, has the design stayed locked in, or are they making modifications that you're aware of?
So we're not aware, you know, once again, there's not that much transparency in it, but the general sort of, unfortunately, it's a very different world than it was in 2006.
The noughties.
But our understanding is that it's going, that there's not that much design evolution that occurred in the Chinese AP1000 sort of base. I think what they spent a couple of years on is solidifying the design and getting that supply chain spun up. And, you know, I think one of the things that we should be clear about here that I don't think a lot of people appreciate is, you know, as we've talked about, the AP1000 really is a large modular reactor. And we often think that the the whole way that SMRs have been pitched to a lot of us is that these things will allow more of the percentage of labor to be done in a factory versus a large modular reactor. And in fact, what sort of peer-reviewed analyses say is it's actually kind of the opposite, right? Generally, because one of the issues that we've talked about with SMRs before is that these small, you know, that these SMRs have so much civil works. And although you can often shrink down the nuclear island modules and the nuclear island itself, bring that all into factory, the scaling, the amount that the civil work shrinks is much slower, is much lower than the amount of capacity that shrinks. So what happens is you start dominating more and more of your cost structure goes into civil works, such that if you take a NuScale plant, right, the NuScale power modules in a NuScale plant cost less than 10% of the overnight cost of a NuScale power plant, which means that a lot of the other labor is shifted, a lot of the other cost, excuse me, is shifted to civil works and other things that are used to improve the plant, they're used to build the plant. As a result, what you see is when you look at analyses, and once again, we're relying on Robbie Stewart's work at Cruz Sherman's lab, for the nuclear cost estimation tooling, what you really do see here is that in a BWRX-300 or an AP300 or a NuScale plant, more of the percentage of the overall cost of the plant is on-site work than on off-site work, than it compared to an AP1000, which is sort of counterintuitive to what I think a lot of what we've been sold on with SMRs. Now, the way I like to think about this is that the microreactors are probably going to be still have the highest percentage if they ever get built and approved. They're going to have the highest percentage of work done in a factory. Then you sort of go into a valley, right, as you get down to the AP300, BWRX300, and you come back up to the AP1000s in terms of percentage of work that's done in a factory versus done at the site. And so that is, I think, another reason why we're really trying to think a lot long and hard about consolidating on a single design and trying to focus on building, deploying half a dozen or a dozen reactors.
Right, right. And I think your airplane and airports analogy was quite fitting there. So with the SMRs, you are making and servicing smaller aircraft, but the size of the airport is not certainly it doesn't disappear. The airport is still there, and it's not decreasing as significantly. So it actually becomes more of the actual cost. You certainly hear that a lot in circles, you know, like we're going to get rid of the airport. We're just focusing on, you know, trying to move to a model of fabrication.
So I think the question,
not like Boeing does, but like Airbus does, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, our model, obviously, for the next AP1000, we're modeling on the 737 MAX is sort of our so going back a little bit, though, to sort of, I think, where what we're talking about here is, you know, with Vogtle 4 and Vogtle 3 is that, you know, anecdotally, we're seeing 30% or 40% cost reductions roughly between Vogtle 3 and Vogtle 4. Okay. And although a lot of people are pretty shocked by that, that's actually, you know, there's a very famous paper by Jessica Levering and Ted Nordhaus that really is arguing there's not really, except for South Korea, there really hasn't been a big learning curve that you were referencing in the United States or even around the world in nuclear deployment. And I think that that sort of is kind of missing the forest for the trees in some ways. If you actually look at the history of U.S. nuclear power deployments, we saw actually dozens of learning curves that occurred, right? If you look at almost every multi-unit plant, right, there was massive cost reductions between the first plant and the second unit, the first unit and the second unit. Palo Verde unit number one to Palo Verde unit number two almost decreased almost by 50%. in terms of overnight costs. Now, there's two, I think, major issues that we have here in the United States. One is that the U.S. never focused on a standardized design. And we were just beginning to have the standardized designs coming out when sort of the, you know, end of nuclear happened in the United States. So, you know, the first real standardized design approval that was ever done, the first licensed design that was deployed was Combustion Engineering System 80 that was built first at Palo Verde, the three units there. And then also it was being built at Washington Nuclear Project 3 and 5, those WHOOPS plants, and it was 84% done in WMP3. So we had that ability probably hypothetically to go down that cost curve. We just were kind of too late almost by the time we started standardizing. But what you saw in like LaSalle Unit Number 1 versus LaSalle Unit Number 2, Browns Ferry Unit 1, Browns Ferry 2, throughout the history of the United States nuclear industry, we really have seen that we see pretty profound drops in the price from the first unit to the second unit and then the third unit if that happens. Or sometimes it levels off the second unit. So that's in some ways what we're kind of missing when we're talking about the lack of a learning curve. There's structural issues in the United States that preclude us from being able to systematically deploy that over and over and over again. And the utility model, the sort of fragmented utility model in particular that the United States utilized for building generation in the regulated utility era in particular was causal here, as well as the fact that the designs were very non-standardized. And once again, we've talked about this, but this is really important as we go back to the topic of this episode, which is Vogel 4 and Vogel 3, to understand that in the United States previous to Vogel and the AP1000 and ABWR plants, it wasn't just that you had GE and Westinghouse and Combustion and Babcock's building different nuclear islands, maybe even different models within that product line, but that the architects and engineers who were designing not only the balance of plant, but also a lot of the critical architecture of the safety systems that support the nuclear island or even ancillary systems like, you know, CV, like chemical volume and charging systems, those architectures often would vary even within the same combustion engineering, you know, nuclear reactor model very, very significantly. And so you got this real heterogeneity in the reactor design. So that also precluded us from going down the learning curve. And the AP1000 is really a different case where we have a totally standardized nuclear island, balance of plant, and architecture that hypothetically can be copied and pasted, for lack of a better term, into different sites, assuming that, you know, it can conform with, say, seismic criteria at the site. Obviously, there's going to be still obviously circulating water design and other aspects. But, you know, one of the things that we have focused a lot on is looking at the licensed AP1000s that were licensed in the United States. There's a lot of them. You know, how much design variation did we see above the base mat of the plant? And what you really find is there's very little that has happened. And they got that through the NRC, which is a tremendous sort of argument here that we have to be able to go down this cost curve post Vogel 4 if we are thinking about this smart. And that's what I think the subject of today's episode should really be on.
Just before we get deeper into that, what you're saying is the second reactor, the third reactor built on the same site experienced a significant cost reductions. The U.S. didn't get to a place in the 70s where it had a fully standardized design and was still deploying to see if that would work between sites. In France, we kind of have that with a standardized 900 megawatt reactor and several other, and those are built between sites. Do we see that between sites? Or like, I guess what I'm trying to say is to see further cost reductions, would that be greater at, say, Vogel 5 or at a new AP1000 site within the U.S.?
So I think you bring up the excellent point, right? And I think your colleague, Chris Adlam, has frequently correctly pointed out that unlike our, you know, maple syrup soaked brethren in Canada, you know, the, you know, you guys deploy these big 4-unit, 8-unit plants, right? Which make a huge amount of sense from an industrial project planning and perspective. Because, yeah, you can standardize the design, sure, but it's great if you can have the same workforce at the same site. You can build them housing and whatnot. And also they can slide along literally as they're finishing up with, you know, the base mat You know, they can go to the base mat on unit 2 and then unit 3 and then unit 4. And then if you're Bruce Power, unit 8, right? You know, all the way up, you're just going sliding down. And that really allows you to retain so much of the lessons learned, the exact same labor, like it's literally the exact same people in many cases doing it. You know, people can plan much more stably to build, you know, because it's going to be a decade or two decades long of build. They could say, okay, you know, I'm going to actually literally move my family here. I'm going to get some permanent housing and really plan to stay there. And all of those sort of fixed sunk costs that you have of, you know, locating stuff, you know, getting logistics in to barge or ship in the various components, that's all fixed, sunk it on the first unit. You get to spread the cost over N units at the same site. So I think that's a really, really important point. So you're right. A lot of what we could be seeing in, you know, the unit 1 to unit 2 cost drops are those. The question that we have to have, and we didn't really see it very much on the French CPY series, although obviously there are 4-unit and 6-unit plants in France as well using that reactor technology. The question that I think is the one that needs to be asked and what needs to be proven is, you know, the CPY sort of product line, that 3-loop product line from Framatome, that really was a stick-built plant. It was not particularly modularized. The question that we have to have is, if we modularize the plant, fully standardize it, will that help with even as we're doing multi-site deployment? Right, to allow us to be able to spread those learning across various other sites.
And to be clear, there's sort of a risk benefit of a hypermodular design. If the modules don't arrive properly, that can actually probably be worse than a stick built design. But again, if you do get that really teed up as the Chinese seem to be doing, it presents a tantalizing advantage.
So I think like any mass produced product that is made on an assembly line, the question that we have to have is, if you were building, you know, the Ford Model T, to use a cliche example, and Henry Ford said, I'm going to build an entire factory product line and I'm going to get, and people are going to buy 2 Model Ts afterwards, that would be a horrible, you know, Ford Motor Company would not be Ford Motor Company today. Right? I mean, if you just built 2 Model Ts, it doesn't make very much sense. You might as well hand build 2 Model Ts, right? The whole way that we get here is the economies of scale, right? And the economies of scale, as we've talked about before, not just in the cost capacity scaling, but in the sort of Wright's Law number of units. And what we're trying to hope for is that, in our opinion, the AP1000 represents the best of both worlds, right? Where you both have the economies of cost capacity scaling, and you have the ability, hopefully, to deploy a dozen or so reactors and really take advantage of them. But that's to be proven.
I guess following up on this site-specific positive learning curve versus potentially the lack or negative learning curve, going over to a different reactor type, the EPR experience in Europe, as far as I know, there's not been 2 EPRs built on the same site yet. Is that correct?
Well, isn't Hinkley Point C 1 and 2 units?
You know what? I thought so, but
yeah. So I mean, I think Hinkley Point C is 2 units, but it's not done yet, and you know, it'll probably be done in, you know, by the time I have grandkids. But yeah, it is 2 units. It's a twin unit. But to your other point, and Taishan unit, the 2 EPRs that we built in China were twin unit facility as well, right? So in Europe, we haven't yet built a twin unit EPR, and if, you know, depending if you consider United Kingdom in Europe or not, you know, either we are building or we are not building one, and certainly not in the European Union. But yeah, we built OL3, obviously was a single unit plant, as well as Flamanville 3, and so we didn't take advantage of that. That being said, you know, to sort of go back to our previous episode from the what's going on with the AI revolution, the return of load growth, I think, really allows us to be planning for multi-gigawatt scale in a single unit site, which I think is really, really good. And you're right. The question that I would have for Vogtle 5, for example, would be, given that there's going to be such a long pause between when construction completed, not only when constructed, but various phases of construction. You know, the base mat was poured on Vogtle, you know, more than a decade ago now. So those concrete workers, for example, those rebar workers, they're probably not there anymore. They're maybe working on some other projects in Georgia. You know, you probably have foremen and other people at the construction site that are involved. But that is not as easy of a transition as it would have been had we been building three units at once in 2012, 2013. Now, in some ways, it was kind of nice that we didn't weren't building three units just because how probably that third unit would have been canceled. You know, one of the things, I mean, we're getting off a little bit from Vogel 4. I mean, one of the things that I think is so amazing about the Vogel experience was is that we finished it. So many of the other nuclear power plants that were dual unit plants originally when planned, they canceled those second units. And you can still see, like, if you look at a power plant like Perry Nuclear Power Plant, right? There's a whole second, I mean, it looks like there's a twin unit plant and just that second unit. Perry is in a BWR6 plant in Ohio. It's just the whole second unit is empty. If you look at Seabrook, you can see the beginnings of the containment building. There's a whole second turbine building there, right? That, you know, that was there. It was just abandoned. And we could go on the list, right? Even a plant like Grand Gulf, right, had two units originally planned for it, and we just only finished a single unit. And I think what we're asking today, and I guess we're off from Vogel 4, but it really presents the question, what is the future of nuclear power in the United States now that Vogel 4 is in commissioning and we don't have any units ordered right now in the U.S. that are serious committed orders, right? We saw the NuScale plant canceled. Right, we have some collaboration with Tennessee Valley Authority on the BWRX 300, but you know there's rumors about Vogel 5, as you mentioned previously, but we don't have anything solid in the books right now. And if you talk to a lot of people who are very worried about climate change, people like Tyler Norris and other folks, what we are starting to see is the utilities are really, really worried about meeting load because of the AI revolution, because of EVs, heat pumps, we could go down the list. And how are we going to make a compelling case, and maybe this should be the focus of this episode, at the end of Vogel, about how we're going to make sure that there's a new nuclear power plant ordered in the United States now, and maybe ideally half a dozen nuclear plants in the U.S. And the critical question I would like to ask and discuss is, should that be one design or should that be six designs?
I have a feeling you have a strong opinion on that matter.
I do, but other people have strong opinions on the other side.
Absolutely. Well, let's try and assess the merits of either side there. You know, just as this is almost, you know, gossip, but, you know, Jigar Shah on, I'm not sure if it was Dr. Volz or another podcast he was on, did mention that there are three utilities in the U.S. that had previously been eyeing SMRs that are looking at AP1000s as being lower risk.
Yeah, it's so that's LPO. The LPO has gotten religion now and has recognized, you know, SMRs are not, you know, well, you know, a lot of people in the community who have been speaking, I think, you know, I think it's been a transition for LPO a little bit to understand the upside, the advantages and disadvantages of SMRs. And once again, the question that I think all of us need to be asking here is, in the case, you know, when LPO is putting out a report saying we need 200 gigawatts to 500 gigawatts of new firm capacity in the United States to meet the Biden administration's decarbonization goals, and you know, the Biden administration is itching to get a nuclear project started in the U.S. We obviously saw them save Palisades. They're looking at other plants that just recently shut down to really help support. The question that we have to say is, you know, what is the policy that we really do need from the federal government to help us ensure that we can build a fleet build out of new nuclear reactors in the United States? And I think there's a lot of folks in the audience probably in the nuclear community who really believe that should be SMRs or advanced reactor technologies. And I think that is, and we should note, you know, previously, I say there's not really another nuclear plant that's really in seriously in development, but there is actually one, right? There's TerraPower's project, which is a liquid sodium fast breeder reactor in Wyoming, that just filed a construction permit, docketed a construction permit with the NRC, and is beginning the Part 50 process for that plant. So there's one. I think there's a lot of people, even within TerraPower, well, not within TerraPower, but around TerraPower, that I think are wondering how the economics of that plant design is going to shake out. And, you know, we've never even, no one who's ever built liquid sodium reactors has been able to get them to be competitive with light water reactors.
Right.
And
even the Ruskies, yeah.
Even the Russians say maybe at 1200 megawatts, they'll break even. They've built 350, 600 megawatts, 800 megawatts electrical. But they paused development of their 1200 megawatt plant at Belayarsk and are redesigning it. So the critical question that we need to ask is, maybe I'll be completely wrong and Kemmerer will come in under budget, ahead of schedule, get the fuel, and we'll knock the socks off of everyone. I'm not particularly betting that that plant design is going to be able to be more competitive than a light water reactor plant.
I mean, this does bring into question, we are going to sort of, I guess, bring our focus back to what you suggested there and stay relevant to Vogel. But this question of design stability, what do you think drives that? Is it sort of an anti-nuclear narrative that it's just nuclear is not good enough, it's not safe enough? Like, how could we be building an AP1000 that was licensed, I forget what year, 2006? That's old technology. We should be doing something new. Like, it seems like there's this, whether it's ADHD or just a perception that nuclear is never good enough and that we couldn't focus on a standardized design because, hey, maybe there's some safety margins by pursuing novel moderator coolant, etc. What's the argument for standardization, saying this is good enough? Where do we need to stop? Should we be stopping? Innovation's a really hot term, but it just seems like the pace of nuclear innovation, especially blue sky innovation, is just very slow because these are large, complex, highly regulated projects. You don't see those kinds of disruptions that we've talked about before in other industries.
One aspect of this has been historically regulatory, right? That under the previous not to get into too much NRC regulatory arcana,
glad you have the self-awareness there, James, but yes, proceed.
Yeah. So let's try to keep this before I lose everyone. But, you know, the process upon which AP1000s are regulated, which is this one-step licensing process called Part 52, didn't come into force until 1987, 1988. And so previously, with the exception of a couple of plants like Palo Verde and, you know, the SNUPS plants at Wolf Creek and Callaway, there basically was like each plant was sort of, there were some cloned plants like I think McGuire and Catawba might have used this approach, as well as some of the Illinois plants, Byron maybe. So previous to this, really, every time you went to the regulator wasn't necessarily bound by what they previously had said. So often, sorry, I don't know what that is. I think this is some macOSX. Anyway, so previously, sorry, there's fireworks.
For the listeners, we got some fireworks.
For the listeners, there's just fireworks that just my computer decided to add to the...
to highlight how exciting this NRC regulatory segment is.
So there wasn't really a standardized design process, just to put it simply. You'd go file a construction permit, file an FSAR, an operating license, application. And each time the NRC could say, even though they had approved this at a previous plant, didn't mean that it was able to be regulated again and without some modification. And the argument that the Europeans give in particular on like the EPRs is that local building fire codes, for example, at the finish at Olkiluoto 3, required a huge amount of modification to the EPR design, just so that it has the most doors and the most number of types of doors of any building, maybe in Finland or maybe in the world, because they had this Finnish requirement that fire building code that you had to basically add doors to each room within the EPR. Of different types. And this is what's getting lore. But, that lack of a standardized design approach that was designed for standardization really did make each plant require to be a bespoke one of a kind. We really have gone a huge amount from that. First, the NRC, started in the 70s, in the mid-70s, introducing two processes called Appendix O and Appendix N, which allowed us to standardize designs, license those designs, and reference a final design approval in the FSAR. And that's what Palo Verde used, Appendix O. Wolf Creek and Callaway used Appendix N. So that's the first part. And then we had it really come super standardized in 1987 with the introduction of Part 52 and design certifications, which basically made the design part of the regulatory code. There's literally an appendix to Part 52, which describes the AP1000 design. Design control. And then we allowed that to be a standardized process. And as I noted, that allowed these multiple COLs that were issued at around the country for new AP1000s to be a really standardized design without regulatory interference causing design variation. Now, the corollary to that is we saw at Vogel 188 license amendment requests changing that license design license. The question is if you built a new one, what proportion of those license amendments would have to be reintegrated into the operating license FSAR that you would be applying for and building when you're building a new AP1000? So that's the first thing. The second thing is the natural variation that was driven by a couple of things. One was, the highly competitive U.S. nuclear steam supply system market, where we had four large fossil fuel companies really trying to insert themselves into the nuclear industry with different designs that varied significantly. And then you had each utility hiring their own architect and engineer that were building their own turbine island and ancillary systems. So the system really became bespoke there. The question that everyone needs to ask themselves now is if we're building more reactors and you're a utility or a customer or an off-taker or a developer, what approach are you going to take? Are you going to demand variations so that the sort of power plant is built the way that you want to build power plants? Or are you going to accept with all the downsides and upsides a standardized design? Because ultimately, it's going to be up to the customer in the United States, absent some real heavy-handed federal policy, to actually choose what that design is. And so that goes back to your question, Dr. Kiefer, right? Is what is driving this? Well, it's a combination of historically it was regulatory issues that at least in the US has to a large extent been kind of, there is a regulatory path that allows us to super standardize the plants and lock that design in and not even have variations after you get a design cert in. But the question, the ultimate question is gonna be the customer who's ordering the plant and developing the plant. Are they willing to basically clone the plant exactly, or are they going to demand tweaks themselves?
Right. Did Fukushima lead to any significant design changes with the AP1000? Like, would a future nuclear accident potentially throw this all up in the air again? I'm just trying to think
about... One of the interesting and I think very positive aspects, although it delayed slightly the issuance of COL issuance for those plants, the interesting thing is that the Fukushima, the revision of the design control document, Rev 19 of the DCD for Fukushima, was actually docketed, I think, like 6 days before Fukushima happened. I believe it was March 4th, 2011. And you had the NRC rather, I think, nicely, if I was, not to be overly complimentary of the NRC, basically sort of say afterwards the sort of cross-cutting sort of Tiger team they put in with the agency. So the AP1000 doesn't really need to have any design modifications for the Fukushima accident. Now, I think that was the right decision because the one of the great things about the AP1000 plant is this is a total passive plant that does not require any like emergency diesel generators, at least for the first 72 hours, right, to cope with a station blackout event. So what happened obviously at Fukushima Daiichi was not that the earthquake or, ruined the plant. It was that the tsunami flooded the emergency diesel generators and associated switchgear, right, of the plant that prevented the sort of decay heat removal from being removed through the active safety systems. The AP1000 is designed to passively cool the plant without any offsite or onsite AC power. Right. So this is if Fukushima Daiichi units had been AP1000s, I think it would have been totally fine. Right. Even if they had placed the emergency diesel generators in the basement, because the plant is passively cooled for the first 72 hours. And then after 72 hours, all you have to do is basically refill the water tank on the top of the containment with seawater or fresh water. And, you can continue passive cooling indefinitely. So the NRC ruled there was no design modifications, and indeed Rev 19 did not get changed at all from that. And that's a pretty impressive, move from the NRC, considering how much design changes and regulatory changes happened post Three Mile Island, that happened in the U.S., and the fact that the Fukushima Daiichi plants were U.S. plant designs, right? Fukushima Daiichi Unit Number 1 was not only a U.S. Reactor vendor, General Electric, BWR3, but it's actually a U.S. Architecture and engineer, Abasco Services, that actually designed that plant, right? So it really was a U.S. plant, although it didn't construct it. But Abasco designed that, the secondary balance of plant for Fukushima Daiichi Unit Number 1. So this was really a plant that was a very similar design to operating U.S. plants today.
Okay, well, where do you want to take this from here on in?
So, I think we got off a little bit to this sort of high level sort of stuff. I mean, I'm not sure where we finished up on the Vogel. It's been years since we last had this episode, but and I have the foresight not to listen to my own episodes. Maybe I should have listened to the last one. You know, I think what we want to talk about here, considering this is our last episode, God willing, about this topic, that, you know, we really think about what the aftermath was of Vogel 3 and Vogel 4. I think, as I said at the last episode, what is amazing, and the kudos need to go to Southern Company, to Bechtel, to Westinghouse, and to the Georgia Public Service Commission, and especially the Georgia ratepayers, for ensuring that the reactor got finished. And I know our friend Patty, I'm trying
Durand,
to remember her last name.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Patty Durand.
Apparently is a very big fan, anti-nuclear sort of person in the public service. I don't know if she's on the public service commission.
Candidate, yeah.
Maybe candidate for the PSC. You know, what she was really arguing vociferously was, it will always be this way, always. Vogel 5 would be an equal amount of disaster as Vogel 3 and Vogel 4. I just don't think that is true at all. I really don't. I think that it is, unless we redesign the plant and made that decision, and the Public Service Commission should never allow that to happen, we have a real opportunity here to go down the cost curves, to learn the lessons from Vogel 3 and Vogel 4, not just at Vogel 5, if that ever comes to be, but at power plants, at sites across the country, if we choose to. I think the question I want to pose and drive this, now that we're sort of at the aftermath of Vogel 3 and Vogel 4, is one, really not underestimate the impact that this has had on the U.S. nuclear industry, and sort of, I would argue, maybe the fear that we all have about building new nuclear, that utilities certainly have. And it's not even Vogel. I think Summer is more of what is driving the fear there. But also ask the question that you were kind of exploring around, Chris, and really talk about that. But what does the role of innovation have here? And in my mind, the biggest mistake we could do is try to build 6 new designs in the U.S. and have 6, and maybe if there are SMRs, mini Vogels occur, right, where those designs really go through all the learning curve problems that we've had. And I want to just ask ourselves as nuclear advocates, it's very unlike the United States to decide on a single design. That is not who we like to think of ourselves as. We're free marketers, we're buccaneers, right? We want to
libertarians
have we're contrarians. We want to have our nuclear power plant design. But what I'm worried about is we need to understand that that comes with costs. It comes with costs, Chris, to be doing multiple reactor designs at once. And certainly that are first of a kind reactor designs. And I don't know of any, and I would challenge anyone, on what basis do we have to think that there's any other nuclear steam supply system that is going to be operating at a higher capacity factor than the AP1000s already have demonstrated themselves at, that have other advantages that are going to be able to outweigh the real cost, the real benefits that we've got from an as-built design with a reference plant that's operating in the regulatory domain that we have in the United States? That is the compelling question I would ask. And my thesis is that it is not that they're right now, the step that needs to happen, the most important thing that the United States needs to do is build another AP1000 and build that thing in 7 years, right? That needs to be the focus of it. Otherwise, if we can't deliver on time and on budget, I don't know, we're going to have a real continuing more and more uphill battle. But I think the highest probability, as I've talked about, I think on multiple episodes of us doing, is learning the Vogel episodes, making sure that the Georgia taxpayer sort of investment and ratepayer does not go to waste, and some people in Florida as well. But that is really, really critically important here. And I want to just say that's what I'm planning on doing and trying to work on.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting in terms of that kind of thought leadership, kind of like intellectual contagion of a paradigm shift. You know, certainly the SMR paradigm has been dominant for the last, I'd say, decade or so. I've been frustrated with it because, at least in terms of the public discourse and conversation, I haven't found it adequate. I'm sure a lot of really smart people are sort of talking behind the scenes, but so far it's felt in the public domain to be largely a branding exercise. And so, you know, in terms of my journey with Decouple, trying to understand these issues, seeing the value proposition of nuclear, seeing how often it doesn't go right in terms of construction. It goes very right in terms of operation almost all the time. But in terms of construction, that's led me towards an acceptance that economies of scale are real, that modularity is great if you can pull it off, that standardization makes a lot of sense, standardizing on really as few designs as possible if they're designs that are operating well, and that the focus in terms of innovation should really be on construction innovations and project management. So I mean, I think that's kind of my program. I think it's starting,
but that's
to
not, you know, I think that's you and I. I mean, and you know, I would even say we're friends at this point. You know, we we, I think, live in this bubble. We don't live in a bubble. I don't mean to be that's, you know, but that is not a widely shared view outside of this ecosystem, or maybe it's more and more shared in the nuclear world. But one of the things that I think what we're trying to do is build a developer organization. One of the key things that needs to happen, that, you know, if you look at the signal that we've had historically in U.S. nuclear project deployment, is that one of the key factors is how well the utility has been able to manage that. You know, the problem is, where does that project management innovation, construction management innovation lie? And it's very, very hard to make the EPC, the engineer or the construction firm or even the reactor vendor do that, because the reactor vendor wants to isolate the risk, especially in the United States, of that. They want to provide their scope and only their scope. The engineering and construction firm doesn't want to take the liability and probably wants to bill you, you know, basically do change orders to make more money on that often. So it really often is going to come down to the development organization that's bringing all these folks together to be able to figure out how to actually build this project on time and on budget, and manage the EPC and manage the nuclear island, just like if you were building an addition to your house. I mean, it's a limited comparison, but I mean, my house is not as big as or expensive as an AP1000. It's almost there, but you know, the. You have to manage your architect, your construction crew, your contractors, right, to make sure that everyone's working together and that all the interests are aligned. In the United States, one of the biggest problems that we've had is that historically in nuclear power, we've had no developer-based project delivery. It has been only based out of the utilities. And the utilities, because they only have so much load that they're servicing, can only build so many reactors before they've met their limit. So even at their needs. So even as we've talked about all this learning curve that we've had, the lack of a learning curve in many ways in the United States has also been structural, because we do not have a centralized organization that is deploying across the country and retaining all the lessons learned on managing a Bechtel or a Sargent Lundy or United, managing a Westinghouse, managing a General Electric, right, to be able to deploy that project on time. So we need to think about it not just in terms of standardizing the design, but literally standardizing the organization that can actually retain all these lessons and deploy it from one site in Florida to another site in Michigan to another site in Nevada to another site in New York, right? That hasn't historically happened because there's different utilities in each one of those things, and they're managing the construction of the plants. So we need to figure that question out as well. And I think that, you know, if you're talking about what I'm working on, as you know, the company I'm working on is exactly, not to do too much spawn con here, like is really trying to figure out, how do we build a development organization that's not Westinghouse, that's not Bechtel, that's not a utility, but more in the model of an independent power producer for nuclear projects like what you have in the gas turbine business that has been so successful at being able to rapidly and affordably and predictably deploy combined cycle gas turbines around the world or around the country, very predictably at on time and on budget.
Right. And I was going to ask about a precedent there. And I was, you know, thinking, grasping at straws of, you know, EDF, for instance, during the Mesmer plan, that you would have that continuity. And obviously that's not going to happen in the States for obvious political and institutional reasons. But you're saying within the gas industry, that's more common in terms of gas power.
It absolutely happened, right? Within, you know, if you look at most of the new generation that's happened in the deregulated power markets, it's not by, you know, Con Edison, like I am here in New York, it's by merchant independent power producers, Calpine, Competitive Power Ventures, and so on, who have gotten really, really good at siting, about developing, about, you know, managing Siemens and General Electric in this case for combined cycle gas turbine deployment, managing the permitting process, managing the offtake of, you know, arranging with the natural gas purveyors, managing the transmission. We really do need to see that happen in the nuclear space, no matter which reactor technology, by the way, we deploy. Because what you see is the real successful nuclear power plants that have been deployed historically really, really are done by the utilities that have done this, you know, have built four reactors previously, or built a dozen coal power plants in the case of like Arizona Public Service, and have the on-site engineering, on-site QA, on-site construction management sort of skills that's not only put together as a person, but that machine has run through this a couple of times, gets that real world experience and retains that culturally. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think Southern, as a deployer of the next Vogtle plant, is a very good option, because the organization at Southern Nuclear out in Alabama really has actually gone through this, and God, they have the scars to show for it a couple of times. So, you know, that ability to deploy another unit really is a smart idea.
And I mean, I'm thinking of other organizations that are running multiple projects, like OPG's integrated project delivery, lots of lessons certainly to learn there. When we were up at the Bruce touring together, actually, they were talking about the Bruce A unit 1 and 2 refurbishments, where they just sort of handed off responsibility to Atomic Energy of Canada Limited at the time and another contractor, and a big curtain went up and lots of delays happened. But that sort of project management, getting involved, multiple entities coordinating, one team, one goal, seems to be something that is helping us succeed.
That is, in my mind, the innovation that we need right now in the nuclear space, period, end of story, right?
Is it sexy enough, though, James? Is it sexy enough? Are people interested? Is it, you know what I mean? It's more interesting to revolutionize nuclear energy and come up with a, you know, disruptive nuclear steam supply system that can, you know, answer all of nuclear's problems, where there'll be no waste and no weapons and, you know, just beautiful, clean power and rainbows.
Well, I think that actually light water reactors on the proliferation part are as good as anything I've seen in resisting proliferation potential, right? No, I'm not going to go any further there. Like, I don't think, no one's ever made a bomb out of a light water reactor.
Yeah.
Not saying, you know, North Korea, I mean, North Korea already has bombs. They don't have light water reactors. And we're going to, and remember, like the US and the South Koreans were building the North Koreans, you know, two light water reactors because they thought the proliferation resistance was so high. But sorry, not to go on that segue. So let's go back here and ask this question. Is it sexy enough? And, you know, I say this as someone who, as I said, you know, as a kid, likes to have my birthday parties as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old at power plants, right? And if you had told that 10-year-old boy that someone would be asking in 30 years or 20 years, sorry, I'm not that old, you know, 20 years, is it sexy enough that your power plant is sexy enough? Power plants maybe aren't sexy. And I don't know how to say this in like a, well, you know, the famous story that happened is by neighbor, a woman, a Nick girl at the time, who was a classmate of mine. We'd have this tour with me, not of a nuclear plant, because it's very hard to get into nuclear plants at that point, but of like the waste to energy, like refuse incinerator power plant that was like local to where I was. And she just thought power magically came out of the wall. You put up sheetrock and you put it in a power outlet. divined out of the, well, because that's a testament to not only how unsexy power plants are, but how good they are at what they're doing. Power plants work, and we hope. And the grid works, you plug in and there's power, right? And the power is relatively affordable, and most people don't think about it at all. And power plants are sort of, they're not the sexy sports cars that they're not your Lamborghini or Ferrari. What we're hoping here are for Toyota, like literally Toyota Corollas, or I don't know, some affordable or Ford Focuses or Model Ts, things that can deliver power reliably, cheaply, and safely, right? And that doesn't necessarily lend itself to sexiness. When I'm thinking about, who I want to hook up with at a bar, I'm not thinking, can this person, well, I mean, maybe some people are, but like sexiness is not like, is this person reliable, cheap, and affordable? Like that's just not, that's not what turns me on.
That's life partner material, but maybe
that's going to be life partner material. But right. That's not what I would consider sexy. Right. Sure. Like it's not sure. Like, you don't think of like, I don't know, a sexy girl or a sexy guy as like, that person, there's not Vogue's, Playboy spreads. I'm sorry, the gay male part of me is putting it, tried to make it more relatable. Whatever you people watch for, wherever the sexy girls are, right? It's not, you're not saying like that girl looks reliable. Like, and that's what I'm trying to say. And I'm sorry to be jokey about this, but that's not what power plants are. That's not what this engineer, this is not a consumer facing product. We're never going to have. Yeah. Nuclear power plants in your backyard, right? Not literally in your backyard. We're never going to be buying nuclear power plants as consumers, right? Unless you're very, very wealthy, right? And the question is focusing on something sexy the right view, or is it focusing on something that is going to be able, that utilities are going to be able to want to buy power from? And I think there's a lot of things that aren't sexy that make a lot of money. And that's what I think we need to be looking for here. I don't think sexiness is what's going to sell us. I think it's, a combined cycle gas turbine is not sexy, I don't think. But they have been extraordinarily, extraordinarily successful, right? Solar panels are not sexy at all, in my opinion. They're just not. Wind turbines, not sexy at all. Hydro dams, not sexy. That's what we're looking for here. And maybe we're too focused on being too disruptive and not doing what the market actually needs.
Let's leave it there with the sex talk. James, it's been fun. I'm sure we'll find new stuff to talk about soon. I guess we had the AI revolution show. I think that's an interesting reference point in terms of increasing demand. I remain skeptical about climate being a sufficient driver to do, I think, the hardest form of power generation. And certainly what's frustrating to me is, China has and Europe now have very strong energy security reasons to go nuclear. They have every reason to. But the Chinese, we're no longer in this globalization heyday of the noughties and can't sort of share lessons learned and supply chains with them. Europe just seems like such a bloody mess right now. It seems to be really floundering on the nuclear side. I wish them all the best. I hope new things come along. Some good news comes from there. Not that there's great news out of the U.S., but I'm just worried that there's not the actual energy security imperative to get moving on this.
So I think the question, and this is a question, which is a Grist article about this, how serious are Google, Amazon, Microsoft at all about decarbonization, right? Because, the hardest part that I think we've talked about before is natural gas right now is at very, very cheap prices. And natural gas, that you could add some solar and wind and do, load shifting, fuel saving, whatever you want to call it. The critical question I need to ask you is this new AI load, are the companies going to put money up for low carbon power? And if they are, then there's a real space for nuclear. But if they're just going to say, we're fine with building gas turbines.
With a little virtue signaling on the side. Yeah. Yeah.
What?
With a little virtue.
It's going to be a really hard economic case. Now, maybe in 10 units, 15 units will be cost competitive. I believe that's possible. But it's going to be really hard on those first couple units to be cost competitive.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for I'm waiting for peak shale and prices to go up before I get too bullish. But that's the cynic in me.
That could be 100 years from now.
I know. I'm aware.
So, I mean, when you're you know, when I'm dead, you know, peak shale might be 100 years from now. You know, I don't think we can bet on that.
Okay, James, right. We're drifting. We'll talk again soon.